This is Scan, and I'm Hal Dreixen. Charles Colson, President Nixon's political advisor, spent time in prison for his Watergate offenses. Previous to his imprisonment, he experienced a religious conversion.
When I was converted and I realized that God was calling me to work in the prisons, I didn't want to do it. I wrestled with God for a year after getting out of prison, literally. But once I made the decision in 1976 that this was to be my life and this is what I was to do, I realized that millions of people, for better or worse, were looking at me and listening to me and being spiritually led, in one sense, by what I would say and do. And so I got a hold of some Christian scholars and some seminary professors, and I said, hey, help me quick. I had earned a doctorate of law. Suddenly, here I am in ministry. You better teach me fast. And so I've been trying to play catch-up ball and soak up my Christian teaching so that I can fulfill the responsibilities that I think God has called me to.
Charles Colson, who due to his Watergate involvement spent time in prison, believes strongly in prison reform.
Well, when I got out of prison, I really wanted to forget that I'd ever been there. Every prison is a stinking hole. I wanted to put it out of my mind. But I found when I got home, I just couldn't forget the men that I'd left behind, many of whom I'd come to love inside that prison. And so the first trip my wife and I took was to go back to prison and visit with the inmates that I'd been in prison with. And I started to go back more and more, and then I realized that I'd been in prison for a purpose. I could not forget the people that were there. And over that next year, I agonized what I wanted to do with my life. In the summer of 1976, I made the decision it was to work in the prisons. Six of us gathered together in a little circle in a rented office, and we started the ministry in a prayer that God would show us how to get into the prisons in America. Since that time, we now have a ministry with almost 200 employees across the United States on staff. We have over 20,000 volunteers active. Last year, 11,000 some inmates went through our training programs. The ministry has been chartered now in 15 countries overseas, and active ministry going on in another 15 or 20 countries abroad. And it has just spread. It's been an extraordinary movement. It is interdenominational. We have people from every church working with us. And it's really the object of the ministry is to encourage the church to fulfill its biblical responsibilities to care about people in prison and to plant churches in the prisons and to build Christian fellowships behind the prison walls and to quicken and awaken the conscience of the church to care about the families of inmates and about the needs of the inmates as they come out of prison.
This is Scan. Charles Colson, a born-again Christian and an ex-con, is against the death penalty. Why do most conservative Christians favor the death penalty?
Well, the new right is stereotyped as favoring the death penalty, but actually it's quite divided. Many members of the new right oppose the death penalty for the same reason that I have all my life opposed it, and that is it's giving the government too much power. You'll find a senator like Bill Armstrong, who's considered a member of the new right, who opposes the death penalty for that very reason. And you'll find some very conservative Christian scholars who oppose the death penalty for the reason that it's not being biblically applied in the United States. I oppose it as a lifelong political conservative on the grounds that I distrust the government too much to give them the right to take a life. I oppose it as a lawyer because I practiced law and I saw that the legal system, best in the world perhaps, but imperfect at that, makes mistakes, and I don't think we should execute mistakes. And we discover every year that there are all kinds of people on death row in the United States who later evidence turns up were not guilty. And there's always a dramatic story of some man who served 20 years in prison and then later evidence discloses that he was innocent and would have been executed but for some last-minute reprieve. Thirdly, from an ethical standpoint, I oppose it because the evidence is fairly overwhelming that it does not deter homicides. If it did, I would have to rethink my position. One evil to prevent a greater evil. Every study has shown that it does not deter. And it's interesting that, for example, two states where homicide rates were about the same, side by side, one state repeals the death penalty, and the homicide rate drops. The other state keeps it on, and the homicide rate goes up. And it's simply a demonstration of Romans 7. That which I want to do, I do not do. That which I do not want to do, I do. Is it the law that makes me sin? May it never be so. It is the sin within me which reacts against the law. And in one sense, the law itself, when it is applied that way, can create the very evil it is intended to prevent. And I've interviewed too many men on death row to believe that it can be a deterrent. Most of your homicides, the majority, are committed among family members or close personal friends, the result of a lover's quarrel. 60-some percent of all homicides are committed by people under the influence of alcohol. Many are paid killers who aren't deterred by the threat of the death penalty. They simply raise the price. So there's no evidence that it's a deterrent. Finally, from a biblical standpoint, I question it. I'm very well aware of Genesis 9:6. He who takes a life, his life shall be taken, because man is created in the image of God. But in Deuteronomy, in setting forth the standards of proof, God prescribed that there would have to be two eyewitnesses before a person were executed, and one of the accusers would have to participate in the execution. Now, that code does not apply to us today. That was the Jewish law for the day. But that code shows us the character of God. And on the one hand, when he prescribes capital punishment, he also prescribes standards of proof, which make it absolutely certain that the person is guilty. We don't have those standards of proof in the American criminal justice system. Far from it. We convict people on circumstantial evidence. As a matter of fact, we convicted and executed Charlie Brooks in Texas when the prosecutor was standing outside the governor's door saying, please don't execute him. We don't know among the co-defendants who actually pulled the trigger. And always I get angry letters from Christians in Texas saying to me, how can you be opposed to the death penalty? Colson, don't you realize Genesis 9:6, he who takes a life, his life shall be taken, because man is created in the image of God? And they throw the Bible at me, and I write right back and say, you Texas Christians, you got blood on your hands. You allowed a man to be executed in your state by other than the biblical standards. You aren't living by the Bible. Where were the two eyewitnesses in the death of Charlie Brooks? And if we had a biblical standard of justice in America, then you'd have another argument. We do not.
You're listening to SCAN. Charles Colson started Prison Fellowship, a ministry to inmates. He was, along with some visitors, visiting a prison in Indiana.
This was at the Indiana State Penitentiary, and I, when I finished preaching in the prison, wanted to go to death row to see two inmates, one Richard Moore and one James Brewer, both black men who had been condemned to die, and both men had become Christians on death row, and a beautiful spirit in their letters. And I had heard from our volunteers about what strong witness they were, and so I got the warden after I finished preaching, and I said, can we go to death row? I'd like to meet with Brewer and Moore. And the warden said that he would take us. And so about 20 volunteers went traipsing over to death row through the long maze of cell blocks to that most dreaded of places, the end of the road. And he opened the gates, and he let the men out. And we all gathered in a circle. It was really a marvelous experience. If you really want to feel the power of God at work, stand in a circle with a bunch of convicts condemned to die and sing Amazing Grace. And through it all, Moore and Brewer had these beautiful, beautiful, radiant expressions. I was due at the office of the governor of Indiana, I think at 5 o'clock that night, and it was now 3 o'clock. I had a private plane waiting to take me to Indianapolis, and so after we'd been on death row for a half hour, I said, we've got to leave. And we all started to file out, and the warden let us out through the double-barred gates, and you had to go into the center section, and the gates in the death row closed, and then they would open into the rest of the prison. And I noticed that one volunteer went back to be with Brewer in his cell. The warden wouldn't let us go out until everybody went out, so I went back to get the volunteer, and I said, we've got to leave. And he was standing in the cell holding a Bible next to Brewer. And the two of them were holding the Bible together. And this volunteer, whom I did not know, looked up at me and he said, no, I'd like to stay just a minute. I said, well, I'm sorry, we've got to go. I've got a plane waiting outside. I'm due in the governor's office. He said, no, please, just give us a few minutes. He said, this is very important. And I said, well, I'm sorry, we got to leave, please. He said, well, no. He said, you see, I'm Judge James Clement, and I sentenced Brewer here to die. But he's now born again. He is my brother, and we need a few moments to pray. I stood in the door of that cell, absolutely riveted. I could not move. I was frozen in my tracks. I looked at those two men, one white, one black, one powerful, one powerless, one the man who had sentenced the other one to die. And in any other context, in any other place, the man who had been sentenced to die would have killed that man with his bare hands. And instead, they stood there with this loving expression between them, reconciled by the power of Christ. And I knew that day that Christ is alive, and he's in those prison cells, and those tombs are empty. And I saw the reconciling power of Christ in people's lives. We walked out of that prison that day, and I said to the judge, I said, I'll never forget this. And he said, neither will I. He said, you know, I've prayed for that man for 4 years. And he said, I didn't know until the day he'd come to Christ. He said, he's my brother. The judge canceled his court calendar the next day, came back to the prison and spoke in the inmate population. And that story had spread all through that prison, of course. And that next day, men were giving their lives to Christ. Just a beautiful demonstration of the love of God, reconciling what would otherwise be impossible human circumstances. When we think that situations are impossible, humanly speaking, we have to remember that Christ will heal those differences if we give him that opportunity. Well, my grandfather was a Swedish immigrant, and my mother and dad happened to be Episcopalians, and I went to church whenever they dragged me. I remember them putting me through Sunday school, and like most kids, I was protesting, kicking and screaming. I went to church a couple of times a year, Christmas and Easter. If somebody had asked me what I was, I'd say I'm a Christian. It's a Christian country. I went to church a couple of times a year. I'm not Jewish. I must be Christian. I did not know what it meant to be Christian. And I really had had just a smattering of religious exposure as a kid growing up, like most kids growing up in America today, and really didn't know what it was all about. No one ever confronted me with the gospel. I don't think I ever heard the gospel until Tom Phillips met me that night. Maybe, you know, maybe I heard it because Billy Graham used to come and preach in the White House, and I used to go to the church services. And I can remember watching Billy Graham and thinking what a great orator he was, but it never struck me to the heart, you know. And I'm convinced that's what happens. There are probably lots of people listening who have heard the gospel. They have heard that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that he rose from the dead, that he lives. I think people hear that. Maybe I heard it. But if I heard it, I don't ever remember hearing it.
You're listening to Scan. After Charles Colson experienced his religious conversion, he immersed himself in classical Christian literature, establishing deep roots for his new faith. One of his favorite thinkers was the early church father, St. Augustine.
Well, he's one of the great heroes of the faith, my view, because second to the Apostle Paul, he would, I think, have to be considered the greatest systematic theologian in the history of the Christian church. And what he did at a time when the Roman Empire was falling because it had been politicized, that is, the leaders had made Christianity the official religion of the state, and so when the state went down, Christianity was doomed to go down with it. Augustine, the bishop of Hippo, the professor of rhetoric, who was a philanderer and a womanizer and had an illegitimate child and lived with a mistress, but was beautifully and wonderfully converted to Christ, hearing a child say, take up and read, and he walked over in the garden and picked up the Bible and turned to the passage in Romans that convicted him of his own sin and caused him to turn to Christ. He became the great, powerful figure at the turn of the 4th to 5th century, which really rescued the Christian faith.
This is Scan. Charles Colson, a political advisor to Richard Nixon and now a born-again Christian, has some insight into the relationship between politics and religion.
I think we've come full cycle. I think in the 1960s, the civil rights movement was largely motivated by people with Christian concern and Christian compassion. They would be considered liberals in terms of the political spectrum. basically what they were insisting upon was God's justice be applied in this society. I think today we've come full cycle where it's the so-called new political right, which is exercising its political muscle and doing so in the name of their Christian beliefs and Christian convictions. And I don't question their sincerity of their Christian convictions any more than I question the sincerity of the Christian convictions of the people on the left who led the movement in the 60s. What I do question is whether we mix religion and politics in the sense of seeking power. I don't think that's the goal of the Christian. Francis Schaeffer, who a great Christian scholar and thinker from Le Bris, Switzerland, says that the goal of the Christian in politics is not power but justice. And I think that's a pretty good summary definition. I think we Christians ought to be working for justice and righteousness in society. I think Jeremiah tells us, is this not what it means to know God, that we care for the poor and the afflicted and the needy? And read the Proverbs. Solomon is constantly talking about justice for people. God is constantly talking about justice throughout the prophetic books of the Old Testament. And so we Christians belong in the political arena working for justice. What I've taken issue with is mixing a particular political point of view and saying that this is the Christian view, because I think Christians work for justice from the left and the right. And in a sense, the tables have turned, but the issue remains the same. And that is that the Christian belongs involved in the political process, both as a citizen and as a Christian. He belongs making his Christian witness, because we are to be the salt and the light, as we are commanded to be biblically, and he belongs being an instrument of God's justice and righteousness in a fallen society. The sad thing about Christianity in America today is that it has been overcome with what I call cheap grace, and that is that we have Americanized the gospel. We have sort of tried to one-up the egocentric culture in which we live by saying, you know, we can get our own thing and do our own thing and get our own way because God's on our side. And we have stopped talking about what it really means to follow Christ, the hard demands and calls of discipleship. And we follow Christ not because what he's going to do for us, because he is truth. And the terrible thing in our society today is we look upon God as a magic wand who's going to get us what we want. We all know God loves us. Karl Barth, when he came to the United States, the great Swiss theologian, one of the great intellects of the 20th century, was asked, when he gathered at Princeton with all the scholars around him, what is the greatest truth you've learned, Dr. Barth, in all of your career and your great theological studies? And he said, the greatest truth I've learned is Jesus loves me, this I know, because the Bible tells me so. We know God loves us. The challenge, it seems to me, for the Church of Jesus Christ today, people of all denominations, is how do we love God in return? And Jesus tells us that the greatest commandment of all is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. But how? Well, he also tells us, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. It seems to me that the beginning of loving God is obedience. It means that we are to obey Christ. We are to do what he commands, whatever the cost. And of course, if we're to do that, we're to take seriously the Bible, what the Bible calls us to do. And that's the reason I feel so strongly about Christians steeping themselves in biblical knowledge. We call ourselves a Christian nation, really a nation of Christian illiterates. Thirdly, the challenge for the church today is to be holy people. We are commanded to be a holy nation, and that is we are to be a holy people, concerned with making an impact in our society for the holy standards of God, which is a concern for the poor, a compassion for the suffering, and a demand that we live righteous lives. And that's really how we treat one another, much more than lifestyle, as we so often confuse it. And finally, the challenge of really loving God is that we have the courage to stand against the culture. The culture today glorifies success. The gospel says serve. The culture says do your own thing. The gospel says bear one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ. The world tells us today that all that matters is that we gratify our own egos, whereas Jesus tells us that what really matters is that we lay our life down for him and for one another. And those are unalterably opposed to one another. Those values are antithetical. And it seems to me the choice for the Christian today is, do I follow the world or do I follow Christ? And the issue is not, does God love us? The issue is, do we love him enough to obey his commands? and to dare to be different and to live as Christians in this society, to make a witness for Christ, and to live as a holy people. And if we don't do that, I see very little hope for us.
You've been listening to a remix version of SCAN, an electronic sweep of the horizon discovering God's activity in the world. We featured the late Chuck Colson on prison reform. SCAN is a production of Select Learning, a continuing education program of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.